Okay. My name is David Jaslow. I'm an emergency physician. I also trained as a paramedic and a firefighter. I'm the director of the Division of EMS and Disaster Medicine at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. Einstein is one of 6 level 1 trauma centers in the city. We have the largest emergency medicine training program in the state with 12 residents a year over 4 years, and we also run the nation's largest fellowship training program in EMS special operations and disaster medicine. Currently, we have 3 fellows enrolled who have completed their emergency medicine residency and are now getting subspecialty training so that we can improve EMS and disaster management systems across the country. With me is Matt Butler.
And I'm the director of the Center for Special Operations Training. My background includes I'm a paramedic. Been a paramedic for 14 years, also trained as a paramedic, firefighter, and a subject matter expert in WMD response. And a master exercise practitioner. So,
master exercise practitioner.
Yeah, and that's my new one.
So speaking of master exercises, we were at a master disaster, the two of us, about a week and a half ago, on the mutual aid response, which we wish could say was the EMS box alarm, but such a term does not exist in the state of Pennsylvania. So we were on a mass casualty incident about 10 days ago that involved carbon monoxide poisoning with greater than 50 patients.
Yeah, I think we had a couple hundred people.
Probably had a few hundred people exiting a building, and an incident that takes place in a state that's a home rule state. So in a commonwealth, all the power goes to the lowest common denominator, which is the municipal level, and therefore the state has no ability to field systematized emergency services. So there is no county-based anything in Pennsylvania. Every town essentially has their own fire and EMS services, which makes it very, very complicated to run a major incident because none of these small town services have enough money or expertise to be self-contained. And a lot of the administrative necessities to manage an incident don't exist because no one agency can afford to have these positions in place. Therefore, we lack training officers, QA officers. There's no full-time, there's no 24-hour fire coverage in the immediate counties outside Philadelphia, which is probably a shock to many people, but it's still a 99% volunteer, which I think also speaks volumes about how difficult it is when you have a major incident to both get the number of people that you need and the correct people that you need to manage a scene and to bring them all together, since training is very difficult to do in the volunteer sector. So Matt and I showed up actually with our respective ambulance services through mutual aid to an incident.
Yeah, I was second due, arrived on scene, and the initial dispatch basically – you could hear the paramedic say, "I need everybody. Send me 4 or 5 more ambulances. People are pouring out of this building."
And I knew it was bad when the fire marshal for the township, which is the authority having jurisdiction, who has basically a take-home vehicle and must have been nearby, was on the scene quickly. And although he has no direct operational authority over any of the volunteer fire companies, does have some authority to ramp up the incident management system. He got on the radio, and again, in Pennsylvania, there's relatively few personnel that are cross-trained. The majority of volunteers and even full-time EMS providers, it's either you're in EMS or you're in fire, but not both, got on the radio and asked the 911 dispatcher, "If we have any such thing as a mass casualty incident plan in this county, you better send it quick." And I think when you hear something like that on the radio, basically, if you haven't self-dispatched, which is the wrong thing to do, but if you know you're in the zone and you're going to be there, you quickly get all your equipment together and plan for a long duration incident, which is exactly what it turned out to be.
So I had arrived on the A side of the building, and just it was a high occupancy building with mostly businesses. Apparently, we were getting kind of sketchy reports of some respiratory type issues. We arrived on scene, and it was very chaotic. People were running out of the building, holding one another up, and very similar to or you know, the WMD training videos of people running out, rubbing their eyes, coughing, gagging. So you immediately think, what's the deal?
In fact, the volunteer deputy fire chief in the fire company whose building this was their district, so he was by unwritten letter of the law in Pennsylvania the incident commander as the most senior officer for that company, remarked to me that when he got on scene, it was exactly like Matt said. His first thought was, this looks just like that video I saw in WMD class. And he said his second thought was, oh my God, I have no idea what to do. And I think that speaks volumes when we talk about how are we prepared? Well, how do you define national preparedness? What's a benchmark to measure preparedness? Clearly, I took a class and I got a piece of paper that says I was there is not the answer, yet that's what many people are using as a benchmark. And clearly, that's what the feds are using to tell the states, if you want your Homeland Security money, you have to prove how many people went to class. What it should be is you have to prove through operational readiness exercises what – you know, how well a job you do, and it doesn't matter if you screw it up. The point is that you have a strategic plan for how you're going to fix it and at least admit that you have to do a better job next time. So we find it interesting as we sit here at the EMS Expo and talk about what's happening with EMS education across the country, and a lot of us believe that it's heading in the wrong direction because it needs to be more sophisticated as medicine changes and becomes more complicated, and not the opposite direction, which is either teach less or expect less, and then wonder why salaries don't keep up and the House of Medicine looks at EMS providers more as technicians than clinicians. That's the key, is when you get to incidents like this, they absolutely prove if you don't know critical thinking, your protocols are going to end and you're going to fall off the cliff not having any idea what to do. So, Matt, why don't you speak a little bit about what triage was like as these patients started to roll out of the building?
We set up, my partner and I, there was one other ambulance that had arrived on scene moments before us. And we had, as a group, decided that we had to do some immediate triage just to get the symptomatic from the asymptomatic separated. So we took scene tape and corralled a parking lot area and corralled these people. Anyone who was sick, go to the left. Anyone who's feeling sick or anyone who's not sick, go left. And anyone who is feeling sick, go to the right. And that was our initial step in the triage. We use a triage, colored triage system that I'm sure everybody else uses. And with this type of event, everybody is a green tag or a yellow tag. We had a very few red tags, only because they were red tags, not because of the event. It was more because of their medical history and their complications of cardiac history and respiratory history combined with this event had sort of pushed them over the edge. So we only had a very few number of red tags. However, we were inundated with these green tags, and the triage model was built on traumatic injuries. It wasn't built for a hazmat incident, so your background sort of takes over, and your skill as a clinician on dealing with what the symptoms were and how serious they were, and that's how we started to have these patients triaged. And why don't you go on?
It's an interesting point to make about START triage. START triage has some validation in the medical literature that it works for high-intensity trauma for which it was designed. It clearly does not work for hazmat WMD incidents because the process of determining who's sick in large part relies on understanding what the natural course of events are if you're exposed to a certain agent or not exposed. You need to know, for instance, how long it takes to develop shortness of breath when exposed to a particular chemical, or does this particular agent cause shortness of breath? If not, the shortness of breath is probably most likely due to anxiety. But especially with this incident, which turned out to be carbon monoxide poisoning, you have a large body of people who are exhibiting the same signs and symptoms that cannot be differentiated anxiety versus carbon monoxide poisoning, because they're all the same symptoms. It's anxiety, rapid heart rate, rapid breathing, you blow off CO2, I don't feel well, my fingers are tingling. And the danger, which we actually saw happen, is that the natural inclination of any individual is to not make work for themselves. So it becomes much easier to try to deny that what you're seeing is illness and claim, what it really is these people are just anxious and there's no big deal here, except that all these people have carbon monoxide poisoning. And of course, when people have low levels of CO, and none of the people we saw had life-threatening levels of CO, they don't really look sick. They look like anybody else, except they're a little upset. It turns out that this incident occurred in a beauty parlor. So who are the people you see in a beauty parlor? They're all women. Many of them are older women. They're all freaking out. And you have to clearly get a handle on, you know, what's the toxidrome look like? What's the most likely mass toxicological incident you're ever going to see, which is carbon monoxide? This is a building that in no way, shape, or form is going to be a target for a terrorist. There's no reason why a WMD agent would be placed in this building. And common things happen commonly, and you have to really think about how to apply what you learn. But the one remark I had from when I rolled up on the scene, probably 20 minutes into the event, a paramedic who was triaging patients recognized me, ran up to me and said, Dr. Jaslow, I'm doing the best job I can. I went through class. I learned start triage. I'm doing exactly what the book says to do. And everyone's ended up with the same color tag. And I'm right back to where I started because I can't differentiate them. And I said, that's because start triage doesn't work for hazmat. And he said, what do I do? I said, well, I'm going to teach you in about 30 seconds. You know, we're going to figure out what this is, and then we're going to talk about, you know, how you figure out who has varying degrees of carbon monoxide poisoning, which is ended up what the event was all about. And then you're going to triage patients based upon which, you know, whether they fall into mild, moderate, or severe illness. And that's how we're going to figure out who to transport first. And that eventually worked. What was very interesting was that Matt was on the front side of the building. I was on the back side of the building. And this was such a large incident area that just to drive from the rear triage and treatment area to the front was about a 2-minute drive. So A, I never even knew Matt was there. And we had an incident with no real management going on, in which there were two completely separate triage sectors and people independently trying to figure out what was going on because there was no communication. So communication fails early in every disaster, especially when it's not pre-planned for. You know, I'm sure that in this particular jurisdiction and in most jurisdictions in our area, they've never, ever in the history of the systems drilled an event where you're at the same event, but you're actually in two different places, and it essentially becomes, you know, area command that you need. And that's never been drilled. So we eventually had to come up with a plan for, you know, how do we relay information and how do we make sure we're all doing the same things and delivering the same standard of care. And it's quite complicated because most of these incidents are dynamic, which means they get worse as time goes by. Car crashes are easy. Car crashes into a tree, whatever number of people are in the car injured, unless a responder becomes injured, there's no way to generate any more patients from that incident, and it's a piece of cake. It's a static incident. Hazmat and WMD incidents are dynamic, and they really are going to continue until such a point as you mitigate whatever the circumstances that caused the event. And if you, you know, recall from just looking at TV, and there was a, you know, incident on CNN last night, plume, you know, train crashes, plume of toxic smoke going up in the air. I mean, that's has the potential to affect thousands of people, depending on how long the plume lasts and where it goes. And so the incident unfolds and gets more complicated before you have your chance to put your hands around it and essentially strangle it and make it stop. So, and it's frustrating because even when you know what to do in these incidents, you have to realize that it's going to take you an hour and a half for things to go wrong before you can actually get that handle and turn it around. But it was interesting for us actually eventually finding out that we were both at the same scene, having no idea that each other was there.
And yeah, really it was treated as two separate. I mean, yeah. it was treated as two separate scenes from an EMS perspective. I mean, there were needs in one triage area that we had the resources. You know, we had an ambulance show up with some spare oxygen bottles that were pulled from one of the local stations, and we had heard later that there was a request for ambulance or oxygen tanks at the other side of the building. So, I mean, there was an obvious failure in communication, and it was pretty obvious right in the beginning that this sort of failure was destined.
It's a good point, and some other observations that we made. I hate when people talk about common sense in emergency services. There is no common – if there was common sense, your mother would be able to show up to this incident and manage it, and that's not the case. These are very complex incidents. Even the simple ones are complex in terms of ramping up an incident management team to make the right decisions. And what we typically see is that people that don't understand how to manage the incident revert back to what they know, which is, I know how to handle an everyday EMS call. The problem is that – when that occurs, what you see are examples like this. You put one or two or three patients in an ambulance, send them to the hospital, and they take all their equipment with them. The medical equipment needs to be at the scene where there's 100 patients. The three people in the ambulance are going to get oxygen off the onboard system. If you take the portable tanks in that ambulance to the hospital, you've deprived the incident of the portable tanks that we need for the patients who will take an hour to transport. Yet on an individual level, what the EMS providers know is, you know, my ambulance is not legally on the street unless that portable oxygen tank is next to the patient. Except in a disaster, it's unnecessary. So we actually had to tackle all these problems where on the individual EMS providers from 20 ambulance services that showed up really did not have the background to make these types of independent decisions. Again, because there are not protocols for these types of things. You have to have the education. You have to go through well-driven exercises. You need a lot of life experience. And again, experience where it's done properly to understand when you're seeing something that's not done properly. And Matt and I both struggled with having to try to teach basic concepts that we take for granted, but again, we are both students and professors in degree programs that are looking at how do you teach this type of education academically to people, and it's very difficult because you can anytime you make an assumption, you're going to make a mistake. You assume nothing. You assume that everyone's at a basic level of understanding, and go from there. Because when you think that other people are making correct decisions, it's usually you're off on the wrong track.
And you're right. I mean, these hazmat incidents are so there is no cookbook hazmat incident. The dynamic, it's ever changing. We during our triage, I mean, we didn't set up. We had triage areas, but we had no zones of operations. So we had at one point a lot of our patients and our patients' families and their coworkers, we started to get bleed over and of the treatment areas. So we had the police sort of security area, but these people would not, the people that were asymptomatic that were cleared to leave, did not leave because they had left their pocketbooks and their keys and all their valuables in the building, and they're not gonna leave. And it's a hazmat incident. But you know, it wasn't hazmat enough, I guess. They didn't see the fire or the smoke or the, you know, people, dropping. So they thought that they could kind of stay there and clog up the system. So yeah, you're right. It's always, ever changing, and, you gotta learn from this mistakes that other people make, like I said, I mean, very, very interesting call.
Takes me back to, a moment in my life. I've got these burned imprints of various parts of my career. When I was in residency in Detroit, I used to hate going to lecture, which is mandatory. Every residency program, no matter what specialty you do, there's always at least a half a day a week where you're required to go to lecture, and the goal is that you cover the entire core curriculum during at least once during your residency training, if not one and a half or two times over. And that's where you learn what you're supposed to be doing properly in the emergency department. So I hated going to lecture. The lectures are at 7 a.m. I'd fall asleep, and I would often say, you know, I'm wasting my time in lecture. Where is Detroit? All hell's breaking loose. People are dying. I need to be in the emergency department saving lives. And I finally had, you know, an attending physician who I really respected come up to me and basically grab me by the arm and shake me around a little bit and say, how are you ever going to know how to do the right thing if you spend all your time in the emergency department doing the wrong thing? You'll never actually know that you're making the mistakes. You go to lecture to say, hey, I screwed that up the last time. I'm not going to make that mistake again. And if you don't know enough, you won't even know that you're making the mistakes. So it's actually more important to go to the lecture and figure out how to do it right, then come back and apply it. There'll be plenty of sick people for the rest of your career. You're not missing any, you know, a shooting or two was no big deal. There's plenty of that to go around. And that was one of the hallmarks that changed me as a physician. And we clearly see this application in the EMS environment, where we've got a lot of providers who, once they get out of their initial education, are never supervised anymore, have no training in the field, never have a physician next to them to explain the complexities that they don't teach in paramedic school. And unless they get yelled at by somebody in the hospital who cares about making a comment that they think something was done wrong, and of course then they're yelling at them and it's not really educational, they'll make the same mistakes for 20 years. And I think this is a huge issue in EMS that most people don't want to talk about, which is that the systems are not funded, educational systems are not funded, and there's a tremendous amount of mistakes being made. And in large part, that's probably why survival statistics and research doesn't show that there's more of an impact from EMS, because we have a lot of providers, but we don't necessarily have a lot of providers that meet standards for competency. That doesn't mean that they're intentionally doing the wrong thing. It's that we haven't developed out these systems to be as sophisticated as they need to be. And I think that's where you move from technician to clinician. The way you get more money, the way you get more respect, is to be able to understand what you're doing, to provide more sophisticated care, to provide that level of risk management where you are able to catch mistakes before they become major problems. And that's really what society, I think, has set as the benchmark for. You want more money, you want more respect, you're moving out of the first level into the second level, so to speak.
Sure.
And there's no
I
way.
I think that cookbook medicine
it's
is.
It's not cooked. There's nothing cookbook.
It's
you have to understand what you're doing and the implications of what you're doing, and it's medicine. It's everything we do is medicine. The decision about whether a patient signs a refusal form and whether they get evaluated when they're refusing care is a medical decision and has huge legal complications if you do it wrong, implications if you don't do it properly, and it's not something that can be taught in 5 minutes.
So, I agree. I think the whole idea of paramedics being clinicians in the field, I mean, if I hear we don't diagnose in the field one more time, I'm going to throw up because, I mean, we do. And we're ever changing. There's that sort of, you have these paramedics that if you see A, you do B. And if you see C, you do D. And that's not the way EMS is going to grow. It's going to become stagnant. And like you said, I mean, we're going to, if you want to make more money and you want to be more successful, you have to think like a clinician and not a technician.
And I think we've reached
a
universal
ended.
Point.
that uncomfortable pause.
Do you want to talk about your dog? Sounds interesting, but little effort.
Okay. I had a
Matt had an incident with a dog, but it's not what you think.
Exactly. All right, I had a we were dispatched to a working fire, and I had finished my USAR medical specialist training, and part of that training is canine care, and. We were dispatched, fast forward, and we were dispatched to a working fire. We had arrived on scene. One of the other ambulances had set up rehab, and they were taking care of the firefighters. There were the home was apparently empty at the time except for a dog. When we arrived on scene, one of the fire officers walked up to the ambulance and said the only casualty was a dog that they had just brought out. And the dog was lying in the front of the residence. The fire was already out. The scene was relatively safe. There were probably 75 civilians standing around the scene. And I had... my first in bag on me, and my partner had all the equipment, and we had decided to work the dog. Part of my reasoning was my training, and that there was a veterinary hospital in the immediate area that would have been, if we were able to at least stabilize the dog, if he was even alive, maybe get some care, some advanced care. So I coated a dog in front of 75 civilians and a bunch of firefighters, and I took a lot of ribbing for that. I intubated him, digitally intubated him, and he was this big, huge golden lab, a beautiful dog that didn't have a mark on him. He had some soot in his airway, but he wasn't burned up. I mean, he looked like he was sleeping on the front lawn. So, you know, we just started working this code, and the what you saw was sort of a something that is right out of the movies, where these people are, you know, egging you on or kind of pushing you along, like, breathe. You know, they're telling the dog to breathe, and it was kind of it was one of those things that, you know, it didn't have the human factor. However, it had that, like, you know, apparently this dog was a popular pooch of the neighborhood, and so we worked the code and did CPR, and unfortunately the dog expired. But a lot of people thought that was a great thing. However, unfortunately I got disciplined for it because I was told I wasn't a vet, which was kind of lame. But I have dogs. I had a dog, and I just thought it was something that I had to do. So, you know, I guess I went beyond the, I'm not quite sure why I did it, but it was something that, you know, you see something or someone, in need, you immediately react, and it's sort of just second nature. I mean, if you're sitting in a restaurant and, you know, I see a kid trip or something, I immediately jump. You know, it's just something, it's in your nature, as a EMS provider, that your ever present, thinking is, you know, how you're going to help someone or how you're going to manage an incident. So that was my story.
Open Airways podcasts are produced by FISDAP with support from EMSresponder.com. All recordings express the opinions and experience of the speaker and do not constitute legal or medical advice. This and other recordings can be found at www.openairways.net.